When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Not long ago, deep in the Appalachian wilds, a group of drunken misfits joined forces to play Dungeons and Dragons. Inspired by boredom, equipped with loose morals and a questionable understanding of the rules, our heroes venture forth to explore strange new lands. So gather up your die, your manuals, and your liver, and join us on a quest as we make absolute fools of ourselves. That's Botched. A D&D podcast, co-created by our guest today, Dennis Robinson. So, let's get to the show. Welcome you to Porch Talk. This is your host, Al, and I am excited about today. I always like to talk to the creatives, and I have a graphic novelist. I like new concepts. A lot of people believe that... the comic book, when it comes to American, is going out of style and that manga is taking over. And I'm going to get a little perspective on what Dennis Robinson here says about that, because he is creating his own world, his own universe with his graphic novel about a lichen named Solomon. Without further ado, here is Dennis Robinson. What's up, brother?
Oh, too many things, Alan. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, man. So, I mean, tell me a little bit about yourself. Where are you from?
So, I am from where I am currently residing, Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, the dead center south of Pennsylvania, you know, the Civil War town, all that jazz. But, yeah, I've been doing graphic novels now. I've been writing graphic novels, the series Lichen, for about... 6 years. First book came out about 2 years ago, and then the second book came out last year, and then the third book is on Kickstarter right now. So I've been just cruising right along now that I put the team together and everything. So yeah.
Tell me a little about your interest in graphic novel. Where did that start for you?
Well, so I have always been somebody who likes to tell stories. We do a podcast called Botched, a D&D podcast, which is like this comedy D&D show, and I'm the DM on that show. Actually, my moniker.
The Dungeon Master. Get out of here.
The moniker that my co-hosts gave me, which has stuck around, is the world's most okayest DM. So that is my title for most things. I've always loved telling stories. And then I really sort of fell into that and fell more in love with it with the podcast we started about, it's been 8 years now. I really don't like to think it's been that long, but oh boy, it's been that long.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. And then because we did the podcast, we got invited to Dragon Con about our second year into the show, and to do our show live at Dragon Con. So we went there and I got to hang out with a bunch of other nerds and talk all sorts of things. And we got talking comics, and I had this idea for doing a graphic novel about the world's first werewolf more than a decade ago. And I just, there's somewhere in this house, there's some rolled up pieces of yellow paper with some notes I scrawled down while I was at Disney World back in 2009. And then I just sort of shelved it and said, come on now. I'm not going to make a comic book. It's whatever. But there's
the audacity, right?
I know. Yeah. And so I pitched the idea to them at Dragon Con. They're like, yeah, no, you need to do this. And I said, okay. And because of the contacts that I've made while doing the show and going to Dragon Con, just meeting people and chit-chatting with people, managed to put a team together, and then we started going from there. And the reason I did the books as a graphic novel as opposed to like just a normal book is, and I don't know if you're this way when you read things, but for me, the moment I start reading something, my mind starts to like go and picture whatever it is that, you know, is written, which mm-hmm. often leads to me not remembering the last two pages of what I read, and then because I've spaced out and gone on to this own little mental adventure. But with a graphic novel, people then get to see it the way that I see it in my head. And that's kind of why I wanted to do it that way, so that people could see it how I envision the book anyway. So that's sort of the long story on how I got into the whole graphic novel thing in the first place and why I went that way.
Dennis, let me just pause right there and give you props. I'm a huge fan. Like when you sent over the work to me, and when I first pulled it up, I was first off, I was taken back by the art. Yeah. And secondly, as I delved into the story, as you described, that's how I am. Like, I like to read, and I also like comic books. But when you're delving into characters and you want to do character development like this, it's fun to be able to see, you know, like you're opening up a comic book, like the bam, the pow, the wow.
Yeah.
And to be able to see all that coming in. And so shout out to the artwork, but also shout out to the story. I mean, you're developing quite the story, the narrative.
Thank you. Now the art, I have a bit of an art background, but not, I'm not doing any of the art in the book because there's not enough time in the universe. These books will come out every decade if I try and do them myself. So I'm very picky when it comes to art, and there was a specific way that I envision everything. And I knew if I was going to do the books, I wanted to do it a certain way. And I wanted to be able to have it go on the paper the way that I sort of see it in my head. And like I said, through networking and just sort of talking to different people, I got in touch with, well, basically I put together this team, mostly through a Facebook group that somebody had put me in. Mm-hmm. And I'd put out, you know, not an ad, but a post, and said, you know, this is what I'm looking for. This is the sort of styles I'm looking to emulate. This is the story. And then people started submitting their portfolios, and I got insanely lucky with the art team that I managed to find. Sal is the main artist for the book. He's out of Spain. Ezequiel Dominguez, he's out of Argentina. He's the colorist. And those two just knock it out of the park every single time. And even the letterer, Joel Saavedra, who's also out of Argentina, I actually met him through my first editor on the book, because that's the editor he uses for his books. And I didn't even realize this, you know, from reading comics over the years, but I talked to Joel a little bit, and he basically drew me a picture on the page, and he said, this is how I do captions in comics. He's like, I'm making the reader go the direction I want to. And he like literally drew a little path, like a little roller coaster ride on the page. He's like, If I make these captions go this way, I make the reader's eye go the way that I want them to go, so I can direct them from panel to panel and all that stuff. And I never had thought about that.
Job before. Well done, too. I mean, he did it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, everybody on the team, fantastic. And one of the funnier stories that I have about the colorist is, you know, I was blown away by his colors when he did, when he submitted his portfolio. And then when he started doing a page for the book, I said, you know, you're doing colors as if it was like realistic. I said, I want you to go crazy with the colors. I think like the Aladdin color palette, like the 90s movie. Like, you know, I get that it's a desert, so it's brands. I was like, let's go oranges. Let's go purples. Let's go blues and, you know, pinks and all this stuff. And he was just like, yeah, all right. And so he just cranked the color up to 11. And, you know, the scenes with like sunsets and nighttime scenes, like those are my favorite in the book, just because he hit it. He just goes so into the color in ways that I love. And I just love the way the books look in the end. And I, like I said, I got insanely lucky with the team I managed to put together.
Before we go any further, I want to step into that just a little bit.
Sure.
Just with manga and the comic book world, the culture in and of itself, do you believe that with you telling your story of the first lycan or werewolf Solomon, mm-hmm. that you are filling a void that is missing in that space?
So I've been going to a lot of conventions over the last couple of years, and I've talked to a lot of people. I met a bunch of other creators that do werewolf stuff. I've not met anybody who really goes into like trying to set up like the lore for the first werewolf. On the back of my book, I even mentioned, because I've had people bring up, oh, you did the first werewolf. Oh, are you talking about like Saint Christopher, or are you talking about like King Lycaon? It's like, no. And so I even mentioned it on the back of the book, like, it's not these guys. We're going further back. Because I wanted to have I love werewolves, but I also love mythology. And this was sort of a way for me to couple those two loves together, where I can have this character who's a werewolf and going through similar sort of werewolf tales or stories that we're used to, but in a setting that we haven't seen before, which is this character going through different regions of history and dealing with different regional mythologies and monsters and folklore. So like the first book is the origin story. So it's just kind of setting everything up. The second book, then we start going into like ancient Arabic monsters and stories of folklore and stuff like that. And then the third book that's on Kickstarter right now, that one is, I describe it as H.P. Lovecraft meets Gilgamesh. And then the fourth book goes into ancient Egypt, and then we go to Greece. And then I would like to, after that, do like a my own version of Journey to the West with like Wukong and stuff like that. So I kind of want to move all over the place and just go into these different. I wish I could do more books so that way I could literally go into like every different like mythology and all that stuff, because there's so much fascinating mythology out there that people just don't know about. Everybody knows about Greek mythology, everybody knows about Egyptian, everybody knows about like Norse. But there's like some just crazy stuff out, especially like Japanese mythology, Chinese mythology, Slavic mythology. Like there's all this crazy stuff out there that people really don't know about, and I hadn't heard of until we were doing Botched, the one season, and we had set it in 1932 New York City in like an H.P. Lovecraft sort of thing. And the reason I picked New York is because it's a cultural melting pot. So I could bring all these different cultures and mythologies in. So I was doing research on like all these different countries, like mythologies, like, the most horrifying, this or that. And I just found so many awesome things. Some of it was goofy, and that's fine too. I love that too. Like, have you ever heard of Uruguru?
Tell me a little bit.
Uruguru is the Louisiana werewolf. It's like a French werewolf. And it operates differently from a regular werewolf. But the funniest thing about it to me is that the best way to defend yourself against Uruguru is to put 13 items on your porch, because Uruguru can't count past 12. And so they get frustrated and leave. Like, just stuff like that, where like, and it's been around for, hundreds of years with or thousands of years with some of these mythologies. So like how people came up with this stuff is just, it just fascinates me. So I wanted to sort of be able to live in that space and sort of tell my story, but also being able to shape it with this, with all these amazing stories from long past that people don't even know about or people have forgotten. And so, yeah, so I would like to think that I'm doing something a little bit different, even if somebody else had already done the first werewolf, just by me mixing in so much other mythology and like gods and all this other stuff. I feel like I'm trying to, do my own little thing here, mixing the two of the genres that I just love.
Absolutely, man. I think that's a very interesting take. Just with mythology and how you mentioned wanting to take your character Solomon the Werewolf through these different places in the world and just offer up the opportunity to mix and meld these cultures, like you talked about in New York City. I find that very interesting. Good on you, man. What a great idea.
Thank you.
Where would you say your fascination with the creation of Solomon come from?
So I've been fascinated with werewolves since I was a little kid. When I was in elementary school, they sort of would stick us in the library every so often, just like to kill time. It's like, hey, the teacher's got something to do. Like, you guys just occupy yourselves for like the next hour or two. And I stumbled across this book. It was a picture book of Lon Chaney's The Wolfman, and I had never seen or heard of a werewolf before. And so when I started flipping through the book and I looked through the pictures and they showed the transformation, all this stuff, I was immediately fascinated. And ever since then, I've always loved these stories of like a duality, like The Incredible Hulk or Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, or werewolves, for instance. Anything where it's almost like two bodies stuck in one body kind of a thing. I've always enjoyed those types of stories. So I knew, you know, when I started getting into, you know, writing stories, this was something that I wanted to do and, you know, mess around with. And then my love of mythology popped up from playing the God of War series back in the early to mid 2000s.
Is that real?
I was so into Greek mythology. Like, I was so annoying on the tours at the museum. Anytime we go in the Greek mythology area. Yeah, no.
I don't want to sidetrack you. Like, go ahead and finish.
No worries. So that's sort of how those two sort of came to be, or two loves came to be. And yeah, in terms of like Solomon and that whole thing, it was just, I was looking back on it and I was, you know, digging through other mythology and I saw the King Lycaon and all this other stuff. I said, well, you know, I want to do my own thing. I want to tell my own story. I don't want to have to, you know, tie it into somebody else's creation that they've already made. I want to make my own thing out of it. So that's sort of how Solomon got birthed and why the series starts in like 8,000 BC.
Very cool. I had another question. I guess it's like preliminary to that. Of why call him Solomon? Is that does that come from Solomon of the Bible, who would be the wisest man that is known? I mean, why call him Solomon?
So Solomon, originally, it was going to be tied into that, you know, King Solomon and all that stuff. Originally, that was the idea. But when I actually sat down and tried to plan out the timeline, because I have the book series figured out all the way to the end of the last book, I just couldn't fit it in to the, like, it just didn't fit with what I was, like, the story I was trying to tell. So then it just happened to be that his name was Solomon at that point, basically. But the original idea was that it was going to be King Solomon and go into that. And I think maybe even on those yellow pieces of paper rolled up somewhere, that might have been on that timeline as well. It's been so long since I've looked at them. I'm not even 100% sure where they are in the house. I know they're in a box somewhere, but I just don't know where they are.
I don't know.
But yeah, so I would say that's sort of why it was. So yeah, to your point, yes, it was supposed to be the one from the Bible, but it just didn't end up working out with the other stories that I wanted to tell to make it fit in that timeline.
Well, very cool, man. You know, he's just as far as mythology. I mean, the Bible may be so far away for so many people. And I found that very curious because Solomon was always a very interesting character in the Bible for me. Mm-hmm. To be so wise, yet to be so foolish. And to see the way that, especially in the first book, when he was really struggling with his duality. Mm-hmm. And what he was trying to do to himself. I mean, how the first book ended,
yeah.
I found it very interesting, and I kind of thought I saw a parallel with that.
Yeah, that's part of why that ended up originally that way. So when I had that idea more than a decade ago, some of that, I guess, just kind of stuck around in my brain. So there are certain personality aspects and parts of that character that I had thought of way back then. And then even after I had shelved it and brought it back, there were still parts of it that I did bring back, even if it wasn't going to be the character from the Bible that I had originally planned on it being. But yeah.
Well, very cool. Well, brother, take me up to today. You have two graphic novels out now. The Kickstarter is for the third. Mm-hmm. Tell my audience a little bit about where to find the previous work. Sure. What you're up to and what they could possibly do to support it. And we'll go from there.
Yeah. So, as you said, I've got two books out in the series right now, chapters one and two. You can find those over on hiveheadstudios.com. I have a store. You can buy them physically, you can buy them digitally. If you want to check out the first 18 pages of the first book for free, that's on there as like a sample digitally as well. Or if you want, because the third book is out on Kickstarter until the end of March, I believe April 1st at 9 a.m. is when the cutoff is. You can back the third book that way, and you can pick up the first two as part of the campaign as well. So you could get all three books, at that point. If you don't want to wait for the first two books until, the third book comes out, because if you back through Kickstarter, typically the way I do it is I will mail all the rewards out at one time. I don't do like piecemeal where it's like, oh, you get this, and then in a few months you'll get this. I usually do it all at once. So once I have all the rewards to send, that's when I will annoy the crap out of the post office and bring in like box upon box upon box of packages and just be like, all right, scan these all in. So usually that's when I do that. So if you want those books right now, you could go to the website and buy them. And that way you'd have the first two,
Plug
and
that
then
one
you could
more
still
time.
back it. Sorry?
Plug that website one more time.
Sure. Hiveheadstudios.com, like a beehive. And then if you
Great.
wanted to go check out the Kickstarter, the easiest way to do it would be lycanbook.com. That's lycanbook.com.
Very cool, man.
Thank you.
I just wanted to go ahead and get that out of the way. I wanted people
Sure.
to know, man. And I believe that listeners of my show are going to be into it as much as I am, because I'm always after something new, especially when it's attacking artistic spaces that I believe aren't being flooded or expanded upon enough. You're in a heck of a market, in my opinion, brother.
Thank
Dennis,
you.
I'm glad it went from playing D&D to being the D&D master to pitching this idea to where we're at now. I'm very happy for you. Like, tell me a little bit about that journey, man. Like, I mean, how are you feeling right now?
Right now, like at this very moment, I would say I feel mostly like the phrase burning the candle at both ends really fits. Because, yeah, I have been. People don't. Not a lot of people understand how much work goes into like doing a Kickstarter. I start planning my Kickstarters a year out, and I've probably put in hundreds and hundreds of hours on this project before it even launched. And then once it launches, that's a whole other ball game. Where you're reaching out to podcasts like you or constantly posting on social media, or for me, I'm going to conventions on some of the weekends and trying to get the book out there that way as well. So it's a constant, trying to get everything out there, especially if you're indie like me, because I'm not a celebrity. I don't have a big following or anything like that. That's just like, Keanu Reeves, who could just drop a book and like boom, instantly will
Yeah,
fund
New York
anything.
Times bestseller.
Exactly. Like that would be amazing. That'd be awesome. But usually if you're indie, it really requires like a ton of work. And I do love the process because it is so much fun planning everything out and getting it all ready to go. Because like, part of the planning for me, I did 27 conventions last year. I don't recommend doing that many because it will burn you out really fast. On top of like a full-time day job. But part of doing that was also networking and meeting a bunch of other vendors and constantly keeping my eye out for, okay, what would make for some good fun rewards to put in the next Kickstarter campaign, like that sort of thing. Or, oh, I really like this artist. And then trying to talk with them about like, hey, would you like to work together to make a print, that we could put in the Kickstarter or something like that. I've met a lot of people that way. There's quite a few rewards that are in this campaign and if come about from previous campaigns, basically from that process. But yeah, not a lot of people understand how much work goes into it. And the story that I tell is there was a couple that I meet at many conventions, and I always talk about, hey, you should do a Kickstarter. They do like an apocalypse romance novel, if memory serves me correctly. And so I would always talk about Kickstarter. And one day he was just like, you know what? It's a really good idea. I'm going to do that. And I got home, and about 30 minutes later, I got a notification, such and such's Kickstarter has gone live. And I was like, no, what have you done? And so I messaged him. I was like, what'd you do? He's like, you said make Kickstarter. I was like, no, not like today. Like, you got to plan it out. And then he set it for 30 days and he didn't really make anything. And he was like, I don't understand what went wrong. And I was like, okay, we're going to have to sit down and have a chat.
Marketing.
Because, yeah, well, marketing, but like he didn't have any rewards plan. Like, there's so many aspects to a Kickstarter that you have to plan out. The page itself, like even just making the page, I work with an art friend to make like banners, like special banners that are specific to that particular book. And then, you know, I take the files and then I mess around with them and add some more stuff to them so I can, you know, make the page even prettier, record the videos. I make goofy videos for every one of the Kickstarters. In fact, if you watch each of the Kickstarters, it's like a continuous story that goes between them where it's like a black and white sort of Lon Chaney sort of feel. Where the first one, I'm like walking around in the woods and I just happen to meet the audience on the night of the full moon and, you know, that whole thing. And then the second Kickstarter, I'm being chained to a chair in a basement and talking about like, yeah, this whole werewolf thing. Like, it's ridiculous. It's fine. And then I'm starting to like change at the end of the video. And then this one, I wake up with my clothes all shredded and like blood all over my face. And like the audience finds me in the woods and there's like a severed limb nearby. And I'm like, oh no, there might be something to this after all. So like those things take a lot of time, and a lot of work too. So yeah, just Kickstarters just take so much work.
Well, I mean, to do,
especially
I find that,
if you're by yourself.
I find that with like every artistic endeavor. I mean, whether, you know, I'm a musician and, independent, like you said. And so if I were to put a song out on Spotify, I'm not anticipating on it getting a million plays the night I drop it.
Sure.
Nor am I anticipating tens of thousands.
Yeah.
I'm just looking for the hundreds.
Yeah.
And I'm just looking to see if it was, if the product, and this is the beautiful thing about being indie, Dennis, is let's just say you're reaching tens of people.
Yeah.
And that's all that you can do. And then the next thing you know, you're reaching hundreds. Well, that meant those tens that you were reaching thought that what you were doing was good enough to share it with hundreds.
Yep.
And like it slowly builds and builds and builds. And then next thing you know, you've got an audience before you and you have a backing. And I mean, we all think about like the Stan Lee or I mean, even like when it comes to film, like a Quentin Tarantino or whatever aspect you want to go down this route. If you want to talk about Jack White or whatever, when in music or whatever your favorite is I think we oftentimes forget that they didn't just show up one day and were there.
Yeah.
You have to plan and get everything out just so. And yeah, you're going to mess up along the way. And I think you gave a lot of great pointers right then to kind of give a little headway. And it's like, and you know what? Maybe your first, your second, your third Kickstarter wasn't a kick. Or maybe your first, second, or third idea wasn't that good, man. Like, have you had an idea before this that you tried to launch that wasn't cooking?
So with this book, so when I had never written a comic before, so I had no idea how to do it. So
yeah, I mean, we all just wake up and know how to do that, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, so if you look at the front of the book, the credits, you'll see like a few executive producers. And what those people are, those are my friends that read the first version of the book that I wrote because I didn't know how to write it. So I wrote this weird mutant script that was like kind of a comic script, but also kind of just a regular book. And the idea was to just sort of get the story out there so I could whittle that down and figure out what I was doing. And they were kind enough to read that awful, awful thing, whatever it was at first, and sort of help me shape things. But I remember, you know, as I was trying to move forward with this process, a friend of mine put me in touch with who would then end up being my first editor, but put me in touch with him. His name's Henri Kumpen. He's another comic creator. He does the Yi Sun Shin series. And he was like, hey, I'm going to put you in touch with my first editor. So I sent it to him. And that guy said, there is nothing redeemable about your books in any way, shape, or form. Not the characters, not the story, nothing. There's nothing good about these.
They tore you apart.
Oh.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com.
Get an 11% rebate at Menards. Rust-Oleum Stops Rust custom 5-in-1 spray paint lets you choose from 5 spray patterns with a twist of the dial. It protects indoor and outdoor metal and wood projects for long-lasting results and is available in more than 40 colors. Get started on your painting project at Menards, number one in customer satisfaction among home improvement retailers according to J.D. Power. For more information, visit jdpower.com/awards.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
He tore it apart and he said, but if you want to pay me $1,800, I'll teach you how to write something that's not this, that's better.
Blow it out of your rear end, bub.
So I said, you know, I appreciate it. And I was about to give up. My one friend, the one that set me up, we met at our, again, through networking. She came to our first live show of Botched at Dragon Con and literally sat in the audience, realized that we live only an hour and a half away from her and said, I'm going to be best friends with those guys. And so she is bent over backwards to like help with like anything that we need. She's like one of the kindest people ever. So when I said, you know, I'm probably going to hang it up and just call it quits before I dig myself any deeper, because obviously this just isn't for me because I don't know what I'm doing. And so then she went back to Henri and told him that. And then she pitched Henri the idea for the book. And Henri reached out to me and said, hey, send me what you sent him. I want to take a look at it. And he comes back to me and he goes, okay, I see what he's saying, but the issue is you don't know what you're doing. He's like, that's the problem. You don't know what you're doing. You don't know what you don't know. So I'm going to teach you how to write a script and how that should be. And so that's what he did. He mentored me and he taught me, okay, here's an actual script, like a template to use. We're going to use that. He's like, this is how, you know, panels per page work. Here's some different rules. You know, this is how many panels per page you should use, not use. Here's how many captions per panel. You know, what's important to put in a caption versus not, and everything like that. So he literally sort of taught me the ropes, and I refined that writing over the course of a few months until I got the script to a decent enough spot. And then, you know, he was continually editing it. And he was on that, I would say the first half of that project, because that first book was a really weird sort of ride because of COVID. Originally, we were going to split the book into two books. So that way it wasn't such a long book. It was going to be shorter books. But when we were supposed to release the first half of the first book, COVID happened. So we pushed the release date a year. By then, both halves of the book were done. So I said, well, screw it. Just put it back together. So it ended up coming out that way. But I would say that's sort of my story of, you know, getting kicked in the teeth and then just trying to change and sort of roll from there. And I would say there was a quote, and I'm going to butcher it, and I apologize for butchering it, but it's one of my favorite.
Oh, dude, I will come through the screen right now if you butcher it.
It's one of my favorite things that Bruce Lee ever said, even though I can't always remember the exact word.
Be like water.
Yes. You pour water into a bowl, it becomes the bowl. You put the water in a cup, it becomes the cup. Be like water, okay? You know, like literally adapt, become whatever it is that you need to be in your surroundings and all that stuff. And I always dug that quote. And so that's what I've tried to do with this. Anytime, you know, somebody says, hey, this could use work, or, you know, you need to learn how to do this or that, I then set my mind to, okay, we're going to figure out how to do that better. And I've been trying to hone it on each of the books as well. Like, the lessons I learned in the first book,
Dennis,
the second, and so on.
How much of yourself are you sacrificing at that stake? Does that make sense?
No, yeah. So, you mean in terms of like,
Your own creativity. I mean, how much, like, I understand, like, someone showing you the ropes and showing how it could and should be,
sure.
but I mean, it's your story.
Yeah. Well,
Do you know what
so
I'm saying?
yeah, no, 100%. And I would say it didn't impact the creativity in terms of the story. He and I used to butt heads all the time on certain things. Like I remember I had heard a buddy of mine who did a comic book podcast or used to, and he would always say the best place to put a surprise is on the left-hand page because you want to flip the page and then boom, there's the surprise. It smacks you in the face. So that's what I was doing. And my editor was like, no, you put the surprise on the right-hand side of the page. So people see that and then they immediately want to read through what they have to get to the other page. And so we would butt heads on that sort of stuff. And like the number of pages in the book and that sort of thing. In terms of creativity or like the story that I want to tell, basically the book as it is the story that I want to tell. I'm pretty stubborn when it comes to most things. And now that I've kind of cut my teeth and sort of figured out this and that, I mean, I always take people's advice, I always take people's insights, and I try and use that to my own sort of benefit or shape what I'm doing, but it doesn't ever impact the stories that I'm trying to tell. Like I always have in mind the story that I want to tell. It's just that I can possibly enhance it or, you know, not even change it, just make it better so it's more engaging for an audience where it's still the story I want to tell, just making it better, I would say.
What else are you finding in your pursuit of storytelling? What's something else that kind of made you stumble along the way?
I would say, well, in a, from a personal life standpoint, is so I'm the writer on the book, and I everything's funded out of my own pocket. So, you know, with the Kickstarters and everything, that's cool and all, but the art team can't wait a year or a year and a half until whenever the Kickstarter happens to be
Oh,
paid
preach,
this number.
brother. I put out records and I do festivals. Tell me about people. Yeah, people don't like waiting.
Yeah, no, not so much. And don't ever tell an artist, I'll pay you an exposure. No. So with that, so I pay as soon as they, you know, make a page, I pay them that day sort of thing. And with that, it ends up in pursuing this sort of dream of mine that it sets me back financially quite a bit. And then it ends up, you know, resulting in not hardship, but just makes certain things more difficult. And sometimes it can impact my relationships with other people, you know, because I'm doing so many conventions. I'm constantly running around trying to get the book out there and things like that. So then I don't have as much personal time. So I don't see my friends as much. Or, you know, whenever I am in a relationship, it can kind of stress things out because I'm not around as much on the weekends. So then, you know, we can't, you know, go do, you know, fun things because, oh, I got to go to another convention, that sort of thing. So I would say that's sort of the other lesson or even just sort of thing I've had to sacrifice or go through on this journey is just, you know, sort of putting myself in a financial hardship of sorts to just try and make the books. Like
Did you
I
watch the
can't
new
buy
Adam
a.
Sandler?
No, I haven't seen it.
Spaceman, you know what I'm talking about?
No, I is that a is it Netflix movie
It
or.
is.
Okay, no, I haven't seen
You
it.
know, he's signed to Netflix. Whether you like Adam Sandler or not, whether you have any interest in that movie, the very thing I believe that you're describing right now is what that movie is about, is he's an explorer, he's an astronaut.
Okay.
And when he gets so far out in his voyage or his storytelling or whatever it is, the pursuit, that he forgets that I made a whole lot of promises to friends and loved ones along the way, and he's not even in orbit anymore. He can't get to them. And so that's kind of the whole point of the film, is like to not lose sight of the ones that you love while you're pursuing what you're trying to do. And I think it's a very tough balance.
And with indie stuff, and I'm sure you know this being an indie artist yourself, is that to get whatever it is that you're working on out there, because you're indie, you have to work on it, you know, twice as
And you
hard as
have to work
somebody.
hard, and it's long hours.
And so the idea, anyways, that we all have is that if you put in the time and you put in the work, eventually, you know, if you build it, they will come, sort of a thing. And it
No,
has,
and it never is that way.
it's never that way. It sometimes happens, but it's not
You
exactly that
always
way.
need a little more help from,
Yes.
and you say your friend, but no, it is a random, like, can I come on your pod? I need more exposure.
Sure.
It is, and dude, I do the same thing. Like, but I mean, and that is just, and I'm happy to have you on board, and I'm happy to have you on my team. But I mean, that is just the nature of the beast.
Yeah.
If like, 'cause I can't just, like you said, with Keanu Reeves or Matthew McConaughey, I just can't go on Conan O'Brien and be like, hey, here's my book. And then next thing you know, I'm a New York bestseller. No, I need a little help from my friends and be like, you got some reach in places that I can't get to. What can we do?
There's a book that another indie comic creator had recommended to me. It's called The Art of Asking. It was written by Neil Gaiman's wife. I can't remember her name off the top of my head, but literally the book is all about don't be afraid to ask people for help. What is the worst that they're going to say? No.
No.
And that's it. Okay, cool. Or they'll say yes, and then they'll help you. And then, you
Or
know,
God forbid they don't write back.
I know.
And
So
how many
that,
times has that happened?
yeah. But in that book, she talks about, you know, people are just so afraid of asking people for help, even though most of the time those people are more than happy to help however they can, especially if they know you and care about you. But for whatever reason, even if we know somebody loves us, we still have a hard time asking for things. And I'm certainly that way. But when I started doing the Kickstarter, I kind of didn't have a choice. It's sort of one of those things. So that's the nature of the beast. You are asking for people to back your project and, you know, that
Dennis, what are
sort of
you
thing.
finding in yourself? Are you finding yourself to be more courageous? Because, like, what you're describing right now is the same thing that I've been feeling, and I'm still been feeling over the past 5 years when I'm asking loved ones and friends for things. Is I thought of myself as a coward. And do you still think of yourself that way, or have you ever, or do you find yourself more courageous?
So I've always been a very self deprecating person. It's just sort of like my nature. But with the book, it's sort of like sink or swim, you don't really have a choice. So for instance, what I mean is at conventions, I'm usually a very I'm an introvert. You could
Oh,
like
get out of here.
parties.
No way.
At parties, I'm not a big no. The more people I don't know at a party, the less I'm just not gonna talk. Unless I've been drinking, then I'll be a social butterfly. But at shows, you sort of don't have a choice. You have to be able to talk to people. And so I, you know, put on the fake face, and I've done a little bit of sales in the past and, you know, a winery or something like that. So I just kind of try and turn it on and pretend to be this other person and do that sort of thing. And then at the end of the day, I don't want to see or talk to anybody till the next day because I am socially burned out. So it's kind of one of those things where it does teach you to be a little bit more courageous because you don't have a choice. It's if you don't do it, then your life's going to be all the more, it's just going to be harder to try and do whatever it is that you're trying to do. And I've seen both ends of that spectrum where Henri, the guy I met or mentioned earlier, that guy, he stands in front of his table, and if you get anywhere near him, he's going to flag you down. And he's got a bookmark that he's flipping around his fingers, and you blink and you've bought 10 of his books and you don't even know what happened. And then parse that with, you know, a creator I was next to this past weekend, super, super nice person and like me, an introvert, but she hadn't really figured out that sociopathic, change into a different person thing.
She was just
So
kind of there.
she was just kind of there and would very mousily ask if people wanted to take a bookmark, but it's so loud, nobody can hear. You have to shout at people. And I don't do the carnival barky thing because that just makes my skin crawl. There's certain lines I just won't cross because it just it just gives me the eebie-jeebies. And that's one line that I'm like, okay, I get that I would sell more books if I did it. It's just not my personality type. Even my sociopath version of me, I can't, just can't do it. It just feels, I don't know, wrong to me, for me to try and do it anyways. But so those are sort of like the different ends of the spectrum that I see where, you know, you could be all the way one way or all the way the other or somewhere like in the middle like me. And you're just kind of trying to like just better yourself each time.
Sure.
Every one of the books, just trying to like hone the skills and get better and like teach myself what to look for, what to change. I was doing, are you familiar with Christopher Priest?
No, I'm not. Dennis, tell me a little bit about that.
So Christopher Priest is one of the main guys that's known for Black Panther. Like he's the guy who made Black Panther into what we know of Black Panther is today. And he's like what I think he was the first black writer at Marvel, first black editor at Marvel, first black editor at DC. Did that. He's the first black writer at Superman because he's on that series right now. And I say all that because I met him at a convention last year. We were next to each other. And he comes over and he says, "Hey, I'm Christopher Priest." I said, "Hey, I'm Dennis Robinson. How you doing?" And he goes, "You don't know who I am, do you?" And I said, "No, I don't." And then he read me his resume. I was like, "I should probably know who you are." And so he actually liked that I didn't know who he was because he hates when people fanboy out on him. So we literally just sat there and just chatted about everything, life, writing, all this stuff over the course of 3 days. And it was fascinating.
Oh, what did you pick up, Dennis?
Well, so one of the things I picked up, so he picked up a copy of the book, the first one, and opened up. He's like, he looked at the captions, and he just goes, "Less is more." He's like, "Don't put so many captions in your book." I said, I know. I'm getting better at that. That was the first book. I had way too many captions. I was trying to whittle it down. The future books, I've gotten a little better with that in terms of like knowing where I can and can't do things. And he also showed me a couple examples from his books of like having a dialogue scene where you basically have a page where nothing really changes art-wise. It's like 9 panels or something like that. But the dialogue changes. And he goes, the point of that is because if your pictures are changing, the reader is going to start focusing on other stuff. But if the pictures stay the exact same,
the dialogue.
Exactly. So if the dialogue changes, but the pictures stay the same, then the reader will hone
read
in more on the words and absorb it better. And so he showed me an example and I was like, damned if he isn't right. Okay. Yeah. So literally we were talking about that stuff and, yeah. So it was a fascinating conversation, just picking stuff up like that from him. And just being able to have those experiences, just meeting people just out of sheer luck, I guess, from, you know, doing shows. Cause you know, what are the odds I got sat right next to him? If I hadn't, you know, there's a good chance.
Oh, you mean to tell me when you bought that booth number, you didn't know you was going to be right by him, Dennis? Come on.
Well, and I don't know if people know this or not. When you apply to conventions, you have no idea where they're going to stick you. It's totally, you find out sometimes the day of the convention where they're going to stick you. So you can put in a request, but I didn't know who he was anyways before that. So I wouldn't have been able to be like, "Hey, put me next to, you know, Priest." I didn't know who he was. And that's the bad thing is I don't know a lot of people in general, just in terms of like name recognition or anything like that. So I find that kind of a blessing in a way, because then I don't ever have to worry about fanboying out on somebody, because I do find that most people would prefer that you just treat them like normal human beings, regardless
sure
of how famous they are.
Sure.
Cause it's just a job. Like, they're just normal people. It's just a job. There's no reason to freak out on them. I tell this story. I went to, it was a convention way long ago before I was doing anything with comics. It was called Nerdtacular. It was a podcaster convention kind of a thing. And I go to this convention and they had a board game room, dozens and dozens of tables just filled with board games, hundreds and thousands of board games. So we go in there the one night, my buddy's wife and I, cause he was in a panel. And we're sitting there looking through the board games, trying to figure out what we want to play. And these three older people came over and they said, "Hey, can we play some board games with you?" I said, "Yeah, sure." So we sit down and we start playing through some board games and we're having a nice chat. And I don't remember how it came up, but I said, you know, "Oh, my buddy works for Blizzard. He works on Heroes of the Storm." And he goes, "Oh, is that right?" I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Oh, yeah, I used to work for Blizzard too." I was like, "Oh, that's cool." Didn't think anything of it. And then, you know, just kept on going the whole night. We just had normal, you know, fun conversations. And then at the end of the night, we got up and left. And I said, hey, it was nice, you know, talking to you guys. Have a good night. And we walked away. And my buddy's wife was like, you realize who we were playing board games with, right? I said, no. And she goes, well, the guy right next to you was one of the former executives at Blizzard, who is now one of the executives at Riot Games. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that's cool. And then the woman next to him is married to one of the executives at Blizzard. And then the guy next to him is one of the executives at Top Deck or Upper Deck Games or something like that.
How about
so
that?
So I was like, oh, that's cool. And every time I saw them that weekend, they'd call me out by name and they would say, hey, how you doing? And I would often forget their names because I'm terrible with names. I can't even remember my own nieces and nephews' names half the time.
Come on, Dennis.
Well, I have 12 of them. I mean, to be fair, there's a lot of names to try to remember. But I remember sitting in on a panel on the last day, and a guy was talking about getting on the elevator, and the guy who used to work for Blizzard got on the elevator with him. And when the doors closed, he immediately started to freak out on the guy and be like, oh my God, I love everything you do. It's the most amazing thing. And the guy goes up and hits the next floor button and just gets off. So I'm like, yeah, it's just a normal person. Don't like freak out. Like, don't be weird about it. Like, it's just a job. They don't like, I don't think most people like to be treated that way. There are certain celebrities that, yes, they definitely do like to be treated that way. But I think for the most part, any of that I've met prefer to just be, you know, treated like anybody else.
Yeah, people just people, man.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, well, Dennis, man, I really enjoyed hearing your story.
Thank you.
And about your liking named Solomon. So I'm going to pose you three more questions and we'll walk this out the door.
All righty.
Number one is, please plug the social media, website, Kickstarter. How can people get in touch with what you're doing?
Sure. So you can hit me up on social media either at World's Most Okayest DM. Instagram's the easiest way, I would say. I'm not really on Twitter too much. Like
one ever. More time. World's Most Okayest
DM. Yep. Like a dungeon master. Or you could do Hive Head Studios, either one, because I have both accounts linked on there. So you could hit me up either way on Instagram. You could go to the website, hiveheadstudios.com, like a beehive. Or you could check out the Kickstarter on lycanbook.com. That's lycanbook.com.
Question number two, for someone who may have never picked up a graphic novel or a comic, what would be something that you would say that would draw them to your graphic novel with Solomon the Lycan?
So I would say if you've never read a graphic novel or a comic, you're missing out because there are so many insanely good stories out there, indie or mainstream, either way, but there's a ton of really good indie stuff out there that you're missing out on. And one of the best things about comic books are the art. You can get some absolutely amazing art in some of these books. Even if there are certain comics out there like Love the Lion. There's not a single word on a single page other than the title. It's just the art. And it's all about telling a story just through visuals. So with my book, and you've mentioned it, I'm really proud of the art. I think it's absolutely gorgeous. So if for no other reason, I think it'd be worth checking out just because it is so beautiful. But I also think I did tell a pretty engaging story, especially if you like mythology, adventure, horror, history, anything like that. I think it is a different take on werewolves and mythology, and I think it's a lot of fun, so I think it's worth checking out just for that reason.
Last question to walk out of the door.
All right.
You ever see Solomon the Lycan getting involved with some D&D? Is he going to be a card? Is he going to be a playable character?
So, actually, for this Kickstarter, we did end up doing a werewolf version of Solomon anyways, miniatures, because I have had people come up to me at shows and ask me if I had D&D miniatures of Solomon. So he could make an appearance at some point. We actually did before the show even started, so it's not on air anywhere. But we did a lycanthropy campaign where each of them contracted a different version. So you had to wear boar, wear rat, to wear bat, you know, all that sort of stuff. But yeah, he could make an appearance at some point. I have a buddy Chris Brown, who does board games, and his one board game, Slaughterville, it's like a horror board game, and he has a werewolf card on there, and he asked if he could use it, and I said, absolutely. He took some of the art from the first book, and he put that on the card, like him wolfing out as the werewolf card, and I was just like, that's pretty sweet.
That is pretty sweet. Oh, well, Dennis, I thank you so much for coming on the show. Solomon, the Lycan, get in there, capture a story, be a part of some indie graphic novels, boys and girls. What have I missed? Anything I missed, Dennis?
No, not that I can think of. And thank you so much for having me, Alan. It was a great time being on the show. And I'd love to come on again sometime.
Right on. Well, Dennis, you take care of yourself, and we will definitely have you back on. I got to pick your brain about some more D&D.
Sounds good.
Then we could save some. save somebody. Glass people cut deep.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.